Gas prices don't usually surge 60 to 70% in a week. But in January 2026, that's exactly what happened in the US, whilst European gas prices still rose by about 20% in a week. There was no pipeline explosion, no sudden embargo, just colder weather than expected, some crowded trading positions, and too many people leaning the same way. Our guest today is Seb Kennedy, founder of Energy Flux. He spends his days tracking gas fundamentals, weather forecasts, hedge fund positioning, and LNG flows. And he explains why markets that look calm can turn fast. In this conversation, Seb walks us through what actually caused January's spike, why funds piling into short positions can turn a normal winter into a squeeze, and how Europe's gas market is now tightly linked with the US, with LNG quietly tying Louisiana to the Netherlands. We also zoom out. Seb talks about Venezuela, a country flaring vast amounts of gas while struggling with energy shortages, a reminder that scarcity is often political, not geological. And he talks about Greenland, a country potentially rich in resources, but decades away from development. It's a warning against mistaking theoretical supply for real security. Together, they point to the same idea. Energy markets don't break because the molecules aren't there. They break when the infrastructure, the politics, the incentives fail to line up. This episode isn't about panic. It's about why gas markets still snap. I'm Ed Porter. Welcome back to Transmission. Hello, Seb. Welcome back to Transmission.
How are you doing, Ed? It's great to be back. Thank you.
Well, our pleasure. Our pleasure. And we said, when we had you on a year ago, Q said that we'll get you back on as soon as we have another gas event. And here we are, gas event in Europe and US. What's going on?
Well, your timing is impeccable, Ed. Well done for engineering the price spike both in America and in Europe in gas markets. Yeah, it's been an absolutely insane couple of weeks in natural gas markets. And as you can probably tell from the bags under my eyes, it's kept me up late figuring out what's going on in these crazy markets. So I'm looking forward to getting into all the elements driving prices higher.
Well, you've got this kind of like, before we kind of get into the real detail of it, right? I think the personal side is, or the behind the scenes of Seb Kennedy is a really interesting thing, right? Because you've both got sort of the energy flux work that you're doing, but then you've got people like ringing you, messaging you saying, "Oh, Seb, like, what the hell's going on?"
Yeah, it's interesting. So I straddle this kind of position between being, you know, a trained journalist, and it's a journalistic platform, Energy Flux, but at the same time, I've focused in kind of laser detail on gas. So I've kind of evolved into an analyst, and I have a lot of my own data sets and data models. And so I straddle both divides. Any given week, I might be calling people up to get them quotes, and then I'll have journalists calling me for quotes. So it's quite an interesting place to be. A week like this, then I've been pretty much, you know, bombarded by requests from readers and from journalists asking me for my perspective on what's going on in these gas markets. I've given, I think, about 3 or 4 interviews this week for, you know, print media, other podcasts. I was at an investment bank talking to their clients. And now here I am with you. So it's and in between, that's just kind of managing requests. At the same time, I need to be on top of the markets, digesting the data, trying to figure out what's happening, why prices are moving in certain ways, what the weather prints are doing, how the funds are repositioning in response to these wild price gyrations, and then scraping the data and then producing a kind of polished product and then, you know, published to readers. So it's pretty full on when the markets go mad.
I love it. And let's then go into this kind of this crazy week, right? So I do want to ask you what's been happening, but just as we kind of build into that, I'm aware that this might be the first time that someone might hear about gas markets. So I'm going to guess you're going to talk about TTF, you're going to talk about Henry Hub. So would you like to just do a quick glossary and then build into that question?
Sure. So yeah, the main two gas trading hubs that we're probably going to talk about are the Dutch Title Transfer Facility. That's the TTF. That's the kind of benchmark trading hub for natural gas prices in Europe. There are other hubs across Europe, more regional, but because TTF is so heavily traded, it becomes the benchmark and other prices are measured as a kind of discount or premium to TTF. And TTF really has a global influence. So when TTF rises, then it pulls up like the price of LNG that gets traded in Asia. And at the same time, you have in the United States, you have a totally separate trading hub called Henry Hub. That's in Louisiana. And it's a similar thing. It's a kind of virtual trading hub that's evolved out of a confluence of pipelines. And that is an expression of the traded price of gas in the lower 48 states mm-hmm. of America.
I hope that is the correct collective noun for pipelines, confluence. I don't have a dictionary in front of me, but we'll check it. Okay, so we've got Henry Hub and we've got TTF, and the last week, which has been a bit of a change. So what's happened?
Sure. So let's rewind. So go back to sort of last summer and autumn, and the best way to understand price formation in gas markets is to look at how investment funds are positioned. And these are essentially speculative traders who make bets on where the price is going to go. They might hold long positions or short positions. If they're long, they're bullish. They think the price is going to go up in the future. If they're short, then it's the opposite. They're bearish. They think the price is going to go down. And we saw the investment funds going net short last year, and they held that net short position going into Christmas. So they essentially got funds carrying a bet that prices are going to go down going into the heart of winter. And I did tell Energy Flux subscribers and anybody that asked me, you know, what do you think about that? And I was like, well, yeah, I am kind of on a macro basis quite bearish on gas. I think the price is going to go down. But in the heart of winter, in a very short period of time, then there's a massive risk that the market could move against those positions. And that's exactly what happened. So as soon as people came back from Christmas and went back to work, and there's a bit more demand in the system, plus, you know, you had weather forecasts coming in particularly cold and gas storage facilities being depleted quite quickly because demand for heating and electricity, gas-fired power is going up, then you saw this almighty correction. So what started with probably a rational correction in the price pretty soon turned into what's called a short squeeze. And that's when traders who are short realize the price is going up and they're basically in a loss-making position. So they have to close out those short positions and rebuy long positions at a loss, but it limits their losses. So you have this scramble to buy long positions in Dutch TTF futures. And when you have, you know, tens or hundreds of funds all buying one commodity for prompt delivery, then that makes the price go up and up and up. So any hedge fund that was long was able to kind of squeeze out the shorts. And this is really, I kind of describe it as like the fundamentals are the spark, but the kind of speculative positioning, that's really the rocket fuel. And so when you get this combination of, yeah, colder weather forecasts, rapid depletion of storages, and funds being net short in the heart of winter, then you get this almighty scramble for long positions that drags the price up. And we saw this incredibly rapid rise in the price of TTF. We saw it rise more than 20-25% in 1 week, and it carried on rising the week after. And so that was the initial kind of price spike on TTF. So by kind of coincidence or not, if you like, I mean, it gets cold in winter, it's not a massive surprise, but in the United States, they're towards the end of the kind of TTF first week of price spiking, then we saw the Henry Hub spike as well. And that was driven by the kind of polar vortex forecasts, which are predicting that the lower 48 states of the US could be blanketed in sub-zero temperatures. And this does two things. It drives heating demand, obviously, and power demand. But the other really critical element is that it also poses a risk that gas pipelines and compressors and gas production facilities might be frozen to the point where they don't work anymore. So the ability to produce gas, ship it through compressors and pipelines and get it to LNG, liquefied natural gas export facilities on the Gulf Coast could be impaired. So you might have, there's this fear, if you like, that the US ability to export LNG is going to be impacted by the cold weather. So those things together caused an almighty spike, like 60% rise on the Henry Hub traded price in the space of about 48 hours. And so what happened when that happens is that kind of has a loop back to Europe, because Europe is so reliant on US LNG, if there's any perceived risk to the security of supply from the US, then that could manifest in kind of scarcity for gas supply in Europe. So we had TTF going spiking up, and then Henry Hub comes spiking up too, and that kind of propelled TTF to go even higher at the start of this week. And so you have like both of these kind of globally important natural gas trading hubs spiking at the same time, which just kind of completely redraws the economics of the value of gas, the price of gas. But it's worth clarifying that these price movements are all concentrated at the very front of what's called the forward curve, because both Henry Hub and TTF, you can trade gas for delivery, you know, tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. And so there are different contracts for delivery. And so all of these price spikes were happening in like the prompt contract. So the
really near term.
The really near term. If you look at like a chart showing the price over time, like the delivered price for, you know, February, March, April, et cetera, then you got, yeah, like February and March spiking super high, and then the drop-off is absolutely immense. Mm. And the further you go out on the curve, then the less pronounced the price rises were.
Well, I think this is a really nice segue, right? So we have this spike in TTF and on Henry Hub at the moment. And I would also like to ask you a little bit about just the context of that, because we are used to very large gas price spikes in the last 5 years. So I'd just like to sort of just put some context around just how large this spike is in comparison to the last spike we saw. Let's do that first, and then I'll come on to my next question.
Historically, this is not unprecedented. You're right, during 2022, following Russia's invasion, full invasion of Ukraine and the curtailment of gas supply to Europe, then we saw spikes that were an order of magnitude greater than this, absolutely, because the shock was just so immense to the system. So some commentators have rightly or wrongly looked at the recent price move and said, well, you know, by historical standards, it's not massive. But if you go like prior to 2022 or 2021, I should say, that's when the prices started going really, really quite high. You know, you go for like in the 1990s, the 2000s and the 2010s, then we didn't see anything like what's happening now. So what you could say is that, this is not historically unprecedented, but if we hadn't have had that gas shock in 2022, we wouldn't be saying that this is somehow normal. It's not normal. Yeah. And by long run standards, it's not normal. Yeah. And the rate of change is, it's immense. And I think if that's your yardstick, if your yardstick is like €300 per megawatt hour for gas, then you're never going to be surprised again by anything. Mm. But, you know, it still matters when the price doubles overnight. It still matters.
Yeah. I think there's in this, you're trying to sort of warn people about like the normalcy bias. They're kind of going, oh, well, you know, this will all be fine. You know, gas will just return back to sort of traditional long run marginal costs. We don't have to worry about anything. But as you say, like if you take out the context of 21, 22, and you actually say, how quickly is this moving compared to conditions outside of that particular period, this is quite shocking. And don't let the sort of fact that 21, 22 happened allow you to kind of sweep the story under the rug and sort of say, it's nothing to be worried about. Okay, super interesting. Let's then go into that slightly longer dated side. So we've talked about the US and we've talked about Europe. So the obvious thing to then talk about is LNG, so liquefied natural gas that connects the two. There is a quote unquote glut of gas coming from the US. How do you see that playing out?
So the glut is real. It is essentially here. I think a lot of people are kind of acknowledging that, you know, the glut is kind of weighing on supply demand balances globally. But we're very much at the thin end of the wedge. So if you look at the anticipated ramp up in liquefaction capacity over the rest of this decade, when we're only starting to see the very beginnings of that, I think we're going to see capacity increase by about 7 to 10% this year. But by the end of this decade, then we could see globally the total amount of liquefaction and export capacity increasing by about 50%. Now, a lot of that depends on whether these projects actually are built. And, you know, the attrition rates can be fairly high. But once a project reaches final investment decision and, you know, the finance is in place, all the contracts are in place, then it does take an almighty upset for that project not to be built. So there are other projects on top of the 50% who don't have the financing in place, who are still trying to achieve FID, final investment decision, haven't done that. I would say they are extremely high risk projects. Like, you wouldn't bake them into your forecasts for LNG supply. But I'd say that, you know, the 50% figure it might reduce over the coming years as like LNG projects, they might get delayed, they take a long time to ramp up, they might have technical problems along the way. Some of them also run over budget and they have these massive cost blowouts, which tend to bankrupt the EPC contractors building them. That's quite common in LNG, so that could happen too. But it doesn't detract from the fact that we do have a very big glut coming and it's going to happen.
So you kind of got these two hats that, or these two worlds that you're seeing. One world is this very sort of near-term, cold weather-driven spike, which is also linked to sort of some of the speculative capital in the space. And then you've also got the slightly medium to longer term where we see this kind of ramping up of capacity from the US to get gas into Europe, which should sort of squeeze some of those prices, sort of bearish sentiment mid to long term.
Yeah, so a really interesting phenomenon happened last year because the way that LNG is priced is a function of two things. You've got the cost of production and then the sales price at the other end. So Henry Hub is a cost factor in LNG. You know, if you buy gas indexed to Henry Hub, let's say it was like $3 per MMBTU, and then you have the cost of liquefaction, which can be anywhere from between like $1.50 to I've seen estimates of like $3, $4, or even above now. That's your cost. And then you've got to pay for the big cryogenic vessel that ships over the Atlantic, and then it regasifies it in one of the many terminals in Europe. You add all those costs together, then your margin is the difference between that and the sales price on TTF. Now, what happened last year, we actually saw Henry Hub rising and TTF was really quite bearish and it kind of it went down quite low to the extent that the long run marginal cost of production, so that's like the full cost, if you include everything, including the cost of liquefaction, actually was the cost of, was above the sales price. So US LNG became technically unprofitable in Europe. Now, that didn't mean that supply stopped, you know, because anybody that's buying LNG, they treat a lot of those costs as a sunk cost. If you sign up for 20 years of US LNG, then that liquefaction cost is a sunk cost. You don't take that into consideration. You still lift the cargoes, you still sell them into Europe. But it was a little sign of what I think is going to happen more and more towards the end of this decade, which is that the cost base of LNG goes up and the price comes down, because the more gas you take out of America and you dump onto global markets, then the more you rise the price. So you rise the price in America, which increases your costs. And you're essentially cannibalizing your own revenue by depressing the price in Europe and in Asia. So that kind of that margin compression is something I've been banging the drum about in Energy Flux quite a lot.
Yeah.
And if you look at the forwards markets, they're already pricing in more events where like the long run marginal cost goes above the sale price.
And this matters, right? Because if I'm a LNG head and I go and put this onto a bank's investment committee and say, can you back my LNG project? They go, hold on, the economics of this doesn't actually work.
Well, it's interesting you say that. That's not actually how it works.
Okay.
Because like I said, you essentially the LNG projects, they push all of that risk onto their buyers, right? So the buyers, they sign up 5, 10, 15, 20 year long-term sales and purchase agreements. And what does that mean? It means that whether you lift that cargo or not, let's say you sign up for 100 cargoes a year, whether you lift 100 or 50 or zero cargoes, you pay the liquefaction fee on every single one. So the LNG plant has, and that's the only way that the LNG plant can get financed, because the bank says, what's the risk that your revenue streams are not as high as you're making them out to be? We're not going to leverage capital into a big infrastructure project on the basis of market risk. So who's going to carry that risk? The bank never takes market risk. They'll always say, can you protect yourself? So that's why we have these sales contracts structured in a way that pushes the risk onto the buyers. So you have the LNG off-takers, who are often utilities, trading houses, big oil companies that are kind of like portfolio players. They'll sign up for like massive, long run offtake contracts with US LNG suppliers. And then they are taking the risk that they'll be able to sell that LNG profitably into end use markets.
So with that information, just to rephrase that around like the offtaker, the person signing that 15 year offtake agreement might look at the potential price of that. And they might look at the forecast around TTF and they may go, well, look, I don't need that. I don't need that LNG contract. Actually, maybe I could serve from another place. Maybe I could be more reliant on TTF.
Well, so let's say you're an industrial consumer in Europe And you're looking at, you need to supply, you need to like firm up your supply of gas so that you can make fertilizer or you can make other chemicals or your utility. You want to generate electricity with it. Then if you're looking at like the outlook for the next 10 years, where's your gas going to come from? Then it's a very hard sell to say, yeah, I need to, you know, lock myself into this kind of punishing offtake contract that could move against me when I can just kind of go to the spot market and just buy gas that's already available.
Yeah. Well, let's stay on that, right? So two things in this. One, less controversial. One, much more controversial. The question that always gets into the press in GB is, well, what about the North Sea? Why not just go and get more gas out of the North Sea? So why aren't groups just saying, okay, I don't like LNG, I'm just going to go to the North Sea and get some more gas?
Yeah, well, very sadly, there's not a lot left in the North Sea. And that might be a controversial statement, but I think that most people would acknowledge it's like, even if we were to drill out every single well that's left, and like maybe we should, maybe we shouldn't, I don't know. Even if we were to do that, then you're not going to move the needle on GB gas balances much. We're talking about like single digit percentages. So, you know, the UK relies on gas imports from Norway and from LNG for, you know, maybe 2/3 of its overall gas demand. Mm-hmm. So it's like, yeah, it would be wonderful, wouldn't it, if GB could just turn around and like cancel all of its imports and we're self-sufficient in gas again. Well, hey, reality check, it's not 1996. We squandered that resource. It's not really there anymore. Mm-hmm. And while there are some remaining resources there, the fiscal regime doesn't support lifting them. I think the lifting costs in the North Sea have tripled in the last 15 years. There's a very high fiscal liability for anybody that's looking to drill new wells. And the decline rates on these existing wells are enormous, and the infrastructure is underutilized in the North Sea. In fact, there's a danger that we're going to have to start shutting down transmission pipelines because there's just not enough volume coming in from those fields to support the maintenance of those. So GB is in quite a precarious state in terms of gas security.
Quick break. If you listen to this show, then you probably work in energy. And at Modo Energy, we're not just talking about the energy transition. We help our users to actually make it happen. All energy storage, solar, and wind assets on the global balance sheet need to be valued and benchmarked. And that's where Modo Energy comes in. Our benchmarks and forecasts are transparent, bankable, and trusted by the world's leading banks, asset managers, utilities, and developers. So if you want to learn more, go to modoenergy.com. And if you want more content like this, sign up to our weekly dispatch newsletter. Enjoy the conversation.
Well, let's go to a much bigger gas field. Let's talk about Russia very briefly. Do you think there's a world in which Russian gas could flow not through LNG, but through pipelines back into Europe? And what would that do to prices?
We could do a whole episode on Russian gas and the geopolitics around Ukraine and will Russian gas come back or not. You can't rule it out. Yeah, a peace settlement in Ukraine could very well include an element of Russian gas coming back. Perhaps it could be sold politically as, okay, we're gonna agree a really, really cheap price to minimize the Kremlin's revenue, to not reward them for their actions in Ukraine, and like hive off a huge amount of that those funds for the reconstruction of Ukraine. That could be one way to sell it. I wouldn't rule that out. What would be really interesting, though, is that, you know, this any peace settlement in Ukraine is going to be at least overseen, if not brokered, by the Trump administration. So are they going to allow something like that and, you know, allow Europe to buy gas below market price from the Kremlin, which would lower the price of TTF, and then that would absolutely crush the margins on US LNG? And I've been wondering for some time, and I've been saying this in Energy Flux, is the Trump administration going to throw the US LNG industry under a bus to get a peace deal through in Ukraine? It could happen. I mean, he's a pretty fickle operator. And while he does use US LNG as a kind of tool of geopolitical coercion in his foreign policy, I mean, I think if it's suddenly not convenient to him for that to be a healthy industry anyway, he'll just let it go. Mm-hmm. And I just to kind of think that through a bit more, I mean, these Henry Hub price spikes, a lot of it is driven by them kind of growing export capacity. Whenever you see LNG exports reducing in the US because there's like a plant goes offline, then the traded price of gas goes down. There's a very close link between export capacity and high prices. If like the MAGA crowd Mm-hmm. If they kind of get a sense that, well, US LNG is now, you know, making me pay more for my power and my gas in my home, all to kind of, you know, bail out these kind of energy poor frenemies on the other side of the Atlantic who we don't care about. That's not America first, is it? Yeah. And I've been saying this for a long time too, like this kind of LNG export bonanza is not compatible with America first. It's not compatible with MAGA. So if Trump feels, or the Trump administration feels like this LNG export bonanza is actually hurting them politically at home, and they could easily kind of cut the cord, impose some sort of curtailment or cap on exports, or just let the market do its thing, let the prices go to a point where lifting US LNG is no longer economic, and that could fix the kind of whole Europe thing, or let them just buy Russian gas again, and you know, for the Trump administration, just wash their hands of the whole affair.
Feels like a bit of a sort of 3D chess move, right? So under political pressure at home, could you fight inflation by bringing down gas prices through a decision like that? You can't rule anything out in the US, but certainly that sounds like a way that this could play out. We will watch this year and see for sure. We've kind of moved on to Trump, and it feels like we are probably a month after Venezuela, but it's still sort of fresh in the mind. We should talk about that. So we should talk about what's happened in Venezuela. I'll pass it over to you to kind of with the brief synopsis of how that's played out, but also what that means.
Yeah. So I actually lived in Venezuela for a few years in the mid-2000s at the height of the reign of Hugo Chavez and Chavismo. So it's been quite, like personally impacting to watch what's happened there. So obviously there was the kind of the military removal of sitting president Nicolas Maduro, the kind of decapitation of the regime. But then it reports are indicating that there was a kind of backroom deal done with his vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, who has subsequently become the temporary president, who is now kind of walking this incredibly just impossible tightrope where she is doing the US bidding, but also trying to maintain this position as the kind of the flag bearer of the kind of anti-imperialist Chavez movement. And I think her position is completely untenable. It is the definition of unstable governance structure, because the minute that the regime is pushed, or well, assuming it's pushed to hold elections, then they're going to be voted out probably. And when that happens, then you're going to see a lot of cascading effects. So in Venezuela, the government, it essentially has these kind of groups of militarized bandits who patrol the capital city, Caracas, whenever protests rise, and they suppress violently any opposition movements. And they're all, their political benefactors are the Chavez regime. If they feel like their political benefactors are essentially placed at risk, they're going to lose their access to funding, to like narco trafficking, economic revenue, or just their direct funding, then they will defend those. Because when if an opposition government comes in, then they're not going to have the same kind of support they had. So the potential for there to be extreme instability in Venezuela is very high. For now, there's this kind of eerie calm, and like my remaining friends and in-laws in Caracas describe life as going on as normal, but it's a kind of very fragile normality.
Mm-hmm. And in that world of instability, you've then got this kind of idealistic, there will be big companies that will move in that will bring lots of efficiency and capital to the export of oil from Venezuela, which will then grease the wheels of wider industry, perhaps bring inflation down. Doesn't seem to be happening.
No, I wouldn't describe it as a total fantasy, but I would say that the scale of investment that you'll see will be far, far below the $100 billion that Trump has been touting around the place. There is low hanging fruit. You will see probably some recovery at some point in production, but let's just kind of take stock of what's happening. Right, there's a US blockade on Venezuelan oil exports, and they're essentially channeling all of the kind of backlog of production to go to refineries in Louisiana. And commodity traders are coming in to kind of help with that, to help kind of, you know, join one up with the other. So yeah, that's happening. I mean, and some of the big oil companies have said, yeah, we'll invest some more. I think there was, is it Shell and Repsol said that they might come in and increase production from the, there's a gas field that operates offshore called Perla. They said they might come in and increase production from that. So there are some investment might happen, but it's like the idea that you're going to have, you know, tens or hundreds of billions of shareholder capital placed at risk in a country that has, you know, periodically expropriated the assets of Western oil companies. And it's the same regime that did it is still in power. It's not like there's suddenly some business-friendly administration that's there now. You know, it's the risks are absolutely immense. And like the ExxonMobil CEO, he got chastised for saying that Venezuela is uninvestable, and I couldn't describe it in any better terms myself.
Excellent. What's quite interesting in that, right? So when you saw the press around Venezuela, a lot of it was around sort of heavy crude and being an oil major. You just described gas as well. Obviously, that's much more where you sort of provide your commentary on a regular basis. Should we be talking about a gas story out of Venezuela?
Well, I have been talking about the gas story. It's a very sad story. So Venezuela is one of the biggest gas flarers in the world. That they flare off immense amounts of gas, associated gas, at the wellhead, because the gas comes up with the oil. And if they can't reinject it into the well, and if they can't gather it and put it through a pipeline and use it for something, then it just gets flared off. It's just a liability at the wellhead. The amount of gas flaring is quite hard to comprehend. I mean, you can see some of the gas flares from space. If you were to capture all of the gas and pipe it over to neighboring Colombia, then Colombia would stop importing liquefied natural gas overnight. But Venezuela is, you know, it's every day. It's just burning off this huge natural resource. But there's no way to get it out of the country. People have been trying for decades to make export projects happen, and they've always run into the same problems, which are, you know, diplomatic tensions with neighbors and sanctions. Mm-hmm. So you've got this enormous natural resource being flared off. You've got the country next door, Colombia, which is importing LNG, which is more expensive. And you've got Trinidad and Tobago on the other side, which is massively gas-dependent economy. They're actually shutting down one of the liquefaction trains on their LNG export projects because they can't get enough gas in to backfill the project to export LNG. They would love to get their hands on Venezuelan gas to liquefy and ship to Europe or to the United States, because they supply the New England Boston area. And they can't do that. There's a really simple project called the Dragon Project. Shell has been trying to get the Dragon Project, it's quite a big offshore gas field, with a very simple 7-kilometer tieback to a platform called the Hibiscus Platform that already exists, with pipelines all ready to go, feed into Trinidad. And they just cannot get any progress on that because they can't get, you know, the Venezuelan government and the Trinidadian government to see eye to eye. And also they've got sanctions in place. They can't get paid for that gas. PDVSA, the national oil and gas company of Venezuela, you know, you can't deal with that company because sanctions, you can't get paid by them. So it's really just this kind of tragic situation where you've got massive waste, massive undeveloped resource, massive need. And this gas, it could be used to rebuild the Venezuelan economy. If they could kind of monetize the gas waste that they're flaring off every single day, then that could create jobs, create investment, create sustainable economic opportunities for the people of Venezuela, because the country is in an absolutely dire situation. And they're flaring off, I think it's like $1 billion worth of gas every single year. You know, that's money that the country could urgently need to rebuild all of its collapsed infrastructure. Mm.
And it's both a sort of political quagmire story, but it's also a technological one as well, in terms of, if you think about oil extraction over the sort of last few decades, gas flaring is a sort of traditional way of dealing with that problem. And so there must be, or there feels to me to be, that there is a element of technological process as well within Venezuela that would need to happen to capture that gas. Is that sort of fair to say?
It is, but to an extent, like, they do have the infrastructure there to deal with it. Like they do have, I mean, certainly to kind of gather the gas and then compress it and re-inject it into the oil wells. And like the compressors are there, but all the compressors are completely dilapidated. Siemens, which is a big supplier of of this technology, they actually couldn't get the spare parts into Venezuela because of sanctions. So, you know, this kit needs to be maintained. The sanctions are in place. They can't maintain the compressors. The compressors get shot. And so they just flare it all up the gas stack because there's no way to get the gas back into the wells. But there's another really interesting element of this, which I explored in a recent deep dive in Venezuela. I didn't know this, but some of the more conventional oil fields in Venezuela, they're kind of depleting. And so what PDVSA, the national oil company, has been doing is getting the gas, what gas they can, reinjecting it into the wells. But they're getting to the point where, you know, it's like you make more money from monetizing the gas than you get by pushing it into the well to produce the oil. So you have what's called a gas cap, and this is the amount of gas in the oil well that's kind of producing pressure to produce the oil. And if they were to essentially release the gas cap, what's called do blow down of the reservoir, you would release an absolutely immense amount of gas. I mean, we're talking about another sort of 10% of Venezuela's entire gas reserves could be increased by releasing the gas cap. But then what do you do with it? There's nowhere to send it because you can't send it to Trinidad, you can't send it to Colombia. What would be the point? You'd be flaring it off again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and final point on this sort of exceptionalism in intervention around, for example, Trump. Do you see that creating much more uncertainty in gas markets over the course of this year? Like, we have gone from Venezuela to Greenland. Greenland appears to now be sort of back down on the list. Some questions around like sort of why that was happening in the first place. But more broadly, do you see this as an example of the type of thing that might happen more in 2026?
Yes. I mean, the Greenland... let me just think about this. It's Greenland.
Don't call it Iceland.
Iceland. So I think that so many diplomatic norms are being broken by the Trump administration. Everything is being weaponized. And you look at this huge reliance in Europe on US LNG. I mean, yeah, okay, so the Iceland thing has been fixed, right? But what's to say that, you know, in a week's time, somebody might say something that annoys him and he decides to kind of bring it all up again? You know, this kind of willingness, this casual talk about military intervention to achieve political ends, it just injects massive geopolitical risk into LNG, which, let's remember, Europe turned to because it didn't want to rely on the geopolitically unstable supplies of natural gas from Russia. Mm. So Europe is in this totally unenviable situation where it's relying on gas from two coercive suppliers, and it's just they're kind of unable to find a place where it can achieve a better balance of energy security and price.
Well, let me then pivot this story to talk about Pakistan. Because I think in that sort of like time of hardship, perhaps, or as you describe it, sort of uncertainty between suppliers, which is, I think, a very fair way of putting it, we've seen countries like Pakistan choose to move away from LNG. So a story that I know you know, but what's been happening in Pakistan in the last year?
So there's been an immense uptake of rooftop solar in Pakistan. Access to cheap solar panels has driven this kind of death spiral phenomenon on the grid, because the grid is underinvested, it's decrepit, the supply is unreliable. People turn to like self-generation to meet their needs. And so that means they pay less to the grid for the power it supplies, which means there's less investment in the grid. And it's kind of this vicious circle, if you like. What that's done is it's reduced the amount of gas that Pakistan needs for power generation. And you've seen gas coming like over pressurization of the gas pipes in Pakistan, because they've got nowhere to use this gas. And Pakistan is a big importer of LNG. They had to essentially renegotiate or seek a new deal on their long-term LNG supply contracts.
The contracts you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, but not with the US. I don't think they buy much, if any, US LNG, not on long-term contracts anyway. They have long-term contracts with Qatar, which is the second biggest LNG supplier in the world. And they have one with Eni, which is the Italian oil and gas major, which is a trade, kind of buys and trades LNG. What's really kind of difficult for Pakistan is that like the Qatari LNG contracts, they are really punitive, because if you're not allowed to resell a cargo, like US LNG, the what it's got going for it is attractiveness, is that you can resell those cargoes anywhere and you can take the profit as a buyer. That's why people sign these contracts. They hope they can kind of like keep the upside from diverting the cargo to wherever it makes most money. You buy Qatari LNG, it docks at a certain terminal or certainly within the country. And if you start selling it to Japan and making money, Qatar's like, you can't do that. You know, we get to keep the profit. And Pakistan's like, well, we've got nowhere to put this gas. We can't take the gas. What are we going to do? So Qatar said, yeah, that's fine. Well, okay, you can resell a certain number of them and you can delay a certain number of them. But if there's any profit on those sales, then we get to keep the profit. And if there's any loss, like if you redirect a Qatari cargo from Pakistan to Japan and you're selling it for less, then you take the loss. So Pakistan's in a real bind, and that's why these long-term LNG contracts can be really quite punishing.
It's both an exceptional good news story, right, in terms of solar and battery in Pakistan allows you to be far less dependent on gas, right? And so to the European story, like what can we do to bring our gas demand down by certain amounts? Yes, like you can see that sort of playing through. But as you say, it can leave you sort of contractually bound because you both need to sign those contracts for LNG to give yourself some security. And like politicians tend to go out the door pretty quickly when the lights go out. So you need the LNG, but also you're seeing this kind of wave of distributed homeowners who have budget, and you have this very sort of simple to install solar and battery solutions that you can start to put on homes. So it's a fascinating piece. I imagine other countries who are growing and looking at these options are starting to go, well, hold on, do I want to sign up to this 15-year deal? Actually, maybe I need to be looking at solar and batteries and what that might be doing to sort of shift my demand. So I need to work out how many sort of LNG deliveries I should be sort of optimizing for.
So what we're seeing in Pakistan is that they're considering upping the import tax on solar panels to make them not quite so cheap and easy to install. They're also looking at reducing the amount of revenue you can get from selling your solar power onto the grid. So if you are contractually bound in the way that Pakistan is, then you might not kind of jump full throttle into the kind of let's do the solar battery thing, because you know, it's like the consumer benefits, but the government is carrying a massive fiscal burden. Don't forget that in like a lot of emerging economies, it's not like private utilities with stock traded on the stock exchange who are signing up for these contracts. It's the state oil and gas company, and they report to the government, and it's all kind of goes directly into the fiscal balance of the government. So yeah, the government might look at this and say, yeah, well, we can like have a massive consumer revolution, but does that mean that I can't afford to pay for, you know, hospitals and schools and things because our fiscal budget's been blown by this LNG contract we can't afford? So that's a kind of, it's a kind of push-pull thing, isn't it?
This is just, it's just so much more complicated than I think people see on sort of first glance, right? Fascinating. I'm going to move us on to a final few questions. So to look into 2026, what would you say some of the big themes are that you would expect to see?
Yeah. So I think that the big three things that I'm going to be watching in 2026, we've covered them today. Like delays in LNG ramp-ups, that's going to be the big critical factor determining how the shape of the glut, if you like. Like I said, LNG projects often go over budget and they have these cost blowouts. Then they chew up the EPC contractor, and then that bankrupts the whole supply chain. If that sort of thing happens a lot, because like labor prices go up, material prices go up, then yeah, you could see that ramp up not happening as quickly as we thought. So LNG plant delays, number one. Number two, Henry Hub price spikes. The whole dynamic around the kind of political acceptability of US LNG in the United States might not become acute this year, but certainly over the next sort of 24 months or so, you start to see it become more intense. And the Russia-Ukraine peace deal, you know, how's that? Is there going to be one? How does gas play into that? I think that's going to come to a head towards the end of this year.
Yeah. So those are three great trends we've covered in the conversation. I've got two more questions. One is the plug, and I'll do it for you. It's Energy Flux, and it's great. If you want to get the inside scoop on what is happening in gas markets, check it out. There's various formats of it. Seb is in lots of places all at once, so you will be able to get access to it. Just type it in and you'll find it. Let's move on to the contrarian view. So is there a view that you hold that a lot of the industry doesn't agree with you?
Yeah, there is. Just on the plug, go to www.energyflux.news, sign up for the newsletter, and you'll find me there. I'm also on social, so you'll find me there too. I do have a contrarian view. So the view is import dependence is a strength, not a weakness. So that sounds completely bonkers, right?
It does, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Now, it's contrarian, so
it should sound a bit bonkers.
Yeah, okay. So think of it this way. I've spent the whole of this podcast talking about how Europe is in an unenviable position where it's reliant on these coercive suppliers, right? But if the market tips in the way that I think it will into one of extreme oversupply, it becomes a buyer's market, right? So if you're a seller, you need demand. You need to find somebody willing to buy your product. And I think Europe needs to kind of weaponize its demand, essentially, because supply is being weaponized everywhere you look. Europe needs to look at its demand as an asset rather than a weakness. It needs to weaponize that. And there are movements around the kind of possible suspension of the US-EU trade deal, which envisaged huge purchases of US LNG. I think Europe needs to do more of that. It needs to kind of treat its demand as a kind of strategic asset that it can deploy to seek to maximize its own kind of political strength on the world stage, if you like, and to really benefit consumers. And so by kind of having flexible demand that it can be deployed strategically, but also obviously like doubling down on the whole energy transition piece, the kind of gas reduction, all the electrification, investing in grids, all of that stuff is only going to increase Europe's kind of overall strength and positioning. And as the market tips into oversupply, then it does change the balance of power between buyers and sellers. And so if Europe and the UK included can kind of find a way to really leverage that power, then it could really improve the outlook for consumers for the next sort of 5-10 years.
I love it. Superb contrarian view. Seb, as ever, thank you very much. Next gas crisis that happens, we'll have you back on.
Oh, I'll see you next week then.